Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Joining me for this special bonus episode is Haley. Haley, can you tell us a little bit about your show and where people can find you?
I'd love to. The new show is called Murder Road Trip, and it's a true crime podcast where I discuss murder cases in my car, aka the Mobile Beats Lab. You can join me for games, mixtapes, snacks, as I make the research journey to murder scenes around the world. You can soon find the show on Stitcher and iTunes, and until then, you can find me on Facebook at MRT Podcast and on Instagram at Twitter at Murder Trip.
This is how this whole thing came to fruition. Haley and I were discussing some cases we were really interested in. So this format is, of course, going to be a venture from what I normally do, but I like to expose you to different cases, different formats, and some of my pod friends, even Haley. We hope you enjoy the episode, and now for the famous line, okay, on to the show.
Tonight, we're going to discuss Anthony Sowell, the Cleveland Strangler. Anthony Sowell was born on August 19, 1959, to parents Thomas Sowell Sr. and Claudia Garrison. Thomas Sr. had four children from a previous relationship, and Claudia had two children from a previous relationship. Their names were Owen and Patricia. She would later have another child named Tressa 7 years after Anthony was born. Thomas Sr. was constantly in and out of prison and was rarely in Anthony's life. This, in combination with his mother Claudia working many jobs, made Anthony become really self-sufficient as a young kid. He was home alone, caring for himself. Claudia moved her family every few months, and the family never got the chance to settle into a school or make any friends. When Anthony was 12 years old, his sister Patricia passed away from an asthma attack at age 29. Her seven children were put in Claudia's custody. And just a little side note to give you a little background on their family. Patricia had five of her children before she was 18. She even had conjoined twins. And Claudia did not hold a funeral for Patricia.
Wow, that's a little strange. The conjoined
She's
twins.
She's mom of the year.
Yeah, conjoined twins, and I'm not going to hold a funeral for you.
Yeah, I guess all of her children, I think she had seven total, had some sort of disability.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Claudia started receiving Social Security money and other benefits when she became guardians for Patricia's seven children. And because of this, she was able to purchase a 10-room house for herself, her own mother, Anthony, Anthony's younger sister, Tressa, Owen, and Patricia's seven children. Claudia and her mother were extremely abusive to Patricia's children. The two would beat the children while they were naked, and they made the other children watch the beatings. Many of the children who grew up in Claudia's house would end up being institutionalized due to the trauma from their abuse.
Were you ever whooped or beaten yourself?
Of course.
Can you explain that to me?
I whooped and beaten.
Right. Well, were you beaten with a switch ever?
Switch, army cord. I was hit with a cane, broom.
Claudia never hugged Anthony or told him that she loved him. But even with that, he was a good student. But he was often picked on in school for being so quiet. Anthony dropped out of high school his senior year when he found out he didn't have enough credits to graduate. But he ended up enlisting in the Marines when he was 18 because he wanted to prove to his mom that he could make something of himself. While at boot camp, Anthony found out his 17-year-old girlfriend was pregnant, and she would later give birth to a little girl named Julie. Anthony thrived in boot camp. He graduated with honors and was the only one in his group to be promoted from private to private first class. And while in the Marines, Anthony learned how to, quote, disable and kill using his bare hands. According to a friend, quote, the Marines taught him all these great standards, how to walk, talk, hold open doors, how to be polite, and how to be a gentleman. As a Marine, he also became an expert in how to observe, how to survive, how to kill, and how to get rid of evidence when you kill. He took his military training and he used it for his own deviant purposes. He would spend 5 of his 7 years in the Marines in Cherry Point, North Carolina. He also served time in Japan, and while in Japan, Anthony started going to the Red Light District, or Hooker Hill, as some call it, in Okinawa City. Anthony's main objective was to find a stripper, offer her a couple dollars for sex, take her back to his hotel, and do whatever he wanted to her. He could, quote, act out deviant fantasies that included bondage, choking, and domination. Because he was a sergeant in the Marines, the women felt like they had to do what Anthony said.
And these are all native Japanese women that he's doing this?
And so I think they were scared of him and just felt like, we better do what he says.
Yeah, because, well, the U.S., so Japan has pacifism as a thing, right? They don't have, I think, a military backing them, so the U.S. does that. So the Marines and the Navy sailors that are there are basically like their line of defense. So they may see it how we see it here, or how women may see it here, is that if somebody in the military, you know, does something to you, nothing really will happen to them, or because of their stature in the military, nothing really will happen to them. And I think maybe that translates over to Japan.
Oh, I'm sure. So even in the midst of hooking up with all the women in Japan, he's still married in September of 1981 to Kim Lawson, who was a fellow Marine. And during their marriage, Anthony had alcohol issues that got him in trouble with the Marines. But for some reason or another, like, they could never find anything in his records to say why. Anthony was never sent to rehab for his addiction. In 1982, a radiator hose blew up in Anthony's face while he was working on a car. He was left with second and third degree burns and damage to his corneas that left him blind for 3 months. And Kim had to take care of him the whole time, which I think was really strenuous on their relationship. In January of 1985, at 25 years old, Anthony was honorably discharged from the Marines. And during his time with the Marines, Anthony had been promoted to sergeant. He earned a rifle sharpshooter award and much more. So he was very successful. And they believe he was so successful because of his childhood and how he finally had structure.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And later that year, Kim and Anthony ended up getting divorced. After leaving the Marines, Anthony moved back to the 10-bedroom home his mother owned, and he shared a bedroom with his nephew. But according to family, Anthony was a different person when he returned. He had anger issues, and he also started drinking heavily again. In 1988, Anthony was convicted of domestic violence. There was no victim named in the police report, so there's no background on what happened, who she was. But he ended up spending a week in jail. And between 1988 and 1989, Anthony was arrested for drug possession, disorderly conduct, driving while intoxicated, criminal trespassing, public drunkenness, and aggravated burglary. Quite the rap sheet. On July 22nd, 1989, Anthony picked up 21-year-old, 3-month pregnant Melvette Sockwell at a hotel. He told Melvette that her boyfriend asked him to pick her up, and she believed him, so she got in the car. Anthony drove the two back to his place, and they arrived there around 6:15 in the morning. He said, "Let's go upstairs," took her to his bedroom, locked the door, and told her to sit down. Then he came up behind her with a long knife, threw her on the bed, choked, and repeatedly raped her. In between each rape, Anthony made Melvette go to the bathroom, wash herself, and put her clothes back on. Then he would repeat the whole process over again. When Melvette screamed, Anthony put a towel in her mouth. She was there for 15 hours before Anthony finally bound her mouth, wrists, and ankles so he could take a nap, because he had been drinking a lot. While Anthony dozed off, Melvette was able to escape through the third floor window. She got the attention of two women who were nearby, but at the same moment, Anthony's younger sister, Tressa, saw Melvette on the roof. She came out there and she asked Melvette what she was doing. Melvette basically said, "Your brother's been holding me captive for the past 15 hours. And Tressa was like, "I didn't hear you scream." She didn't believe what Melvette was saying, but she did eventually untie her restraints. And the police soon arrived. Melvette was taken to the hospital to be treated for her injuries. Anthony was arrested for multiple counts of rape and kidnapping, but he was released on bail and he didn't show up to his court hearing. So an arrest warrant was issued. 8 months later, on June 24th, 1990, Anthony, still on the run from the law, choked and raped a 31-year-old Cleveland woman. When Anthony fell asleep, the woman was able to escape and call authorities. Anthony's charges were dropped when the victim wouldn't testify. Although the charges were dropped, Anthony was finally in police custody for the rape of Melvette. On September 12, 1990, Anthony was sentenced to 5 to 15 years to be served at Lorain Correctional Institution, and during his stay, he would be transferred 3 times. While in prison, Anthony earned his GED. He was also a model prisoner. Many people related his time as an inmate to his time as a Marine. He thrived in that structured setting. However, Anthony did not receive sex offender treatment. He signed up in 1993, but was denied admission because he refused to admit to his sex offenses. And because of this, Anthony had to serve the full 15-year sentence. Before his release, Anthony's father passed away in 2004. And during his 15-year sentence, Anthony only had a few family visits. Upon his June 20th, 2005 release, Anthony was labeled as a 6% chance to reoffend. He was classified as a sexually oriented offender, which is the lowest classification. And this meant that his neighbors did not have to be notified of his classification. After being released from prison, Anthony moved in with his sister, Tressa, and her 9 children. Many of which she had, I think she got pregnant for the first time as a very young teenager. In July, Anthony moved to his stepmother's multi-level house at 12205 Imperial Avenue. And after moving in, his stepmother became ill and was hospitalized. But I don't believe she ever moved back to the house. Shortly after moving into the Imperial house, Anthony met Lori Frazier. The two soon started dating, but Anthony quickly found out that Lori was a crack addict. Before he knew it, he was working at a rubber factory while Lori stayed home at the Imperial House. Their relationship was great until Anthony started smoking crack as well. After he started, the relationship began to crumble because Anthony's personality changed. His house became unorganized and messy, when before it was like a marine barrack. It was completely spotless and clean. He started throwing parties, and he was really mean and abusive to Lori. An interesting fact about Lori is she was the niece of the Cleveland mayor. Some say that she didn't want to be with Anthony after he started having a crack addiction because she didn't want to be associated with him. In February of 2007, Anthony underwent heart surgery to clear his clogged arteries and put in a pacemaker. Anthony never went to rehab and eventually was let go from the rubber factory because he could not perform the physical requirements. Because he didn't have a job, he began scrapping, which is scavenging and selling copper. At this time, Lori stopped living with Anthony full-time, and eventually she broke up with him. According to a friend, Anthony said he, quote, felt betrayed and he would get revenge. So in my eyes, this is where things change. The Imperial Street neighborhood was rampant with drug houses, poverty, and crime. The neighborhood was the perfect place for Anthony to throw parties and meet desperate young women. Women that would do anything for a little crack. This is exactly how Anthony met his first victim. In May 2000, 38-year-old Crystal Dozier went to Anthony's house for a fix. It is unclear what happened, but at some point, Anthony bound Crystal's ankles and hands with cable. Then he strangled her with a knotted cloth, which he kept around her neck. He never removed it. He put a trash bag over her upper body and then a second trash bag over her lower body. Then he wrapped duct tape around both trash bags. Then he dug a shallow grave in the backyard, put Crystal's body in it, and covered her body with a thin layer of dirt and plywood. On June 11th, 2007, one of Crystal's children filed a missing persons report. And the reason they waited so long was because she had gone missing before, and so it wasn't that weird for her to be gone for long periods of time. Authorities received multiple complaints about foul smells coming from Anthony's house, but authorities ruled that the odor was most likely from a dead animal or the sausage factory next door. Well, and what's really messed up is that because of the complaints, the sausage factory had to replace like tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff because people kept saying it was the smell. But the complaints about the smells would last for the rest of 2007.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
So what happened in 2008?
After the murder of Crystal Dozier, Anthony would wait a full year before getting the urge to kill again. In June of 2008, Tashauna Culver, who was 31 years old at the time and a nursing assistant slash beautician, lived just a few doors down from Anthony on Imperial Avenue with her sister, LaTanya. She was estranged from her family since March of that same year because of her crack addiction and alcoholism, but she was really wanting to score a big hit, meaning a crack rock. She wasn't a bad child growing up, and I think that you'll see this a lot with a lot of the women that I'm going to bring up, but over time, she did begin to increase her drug usage after the death of her boyfriend, Marcus Johnson. He committed suicide in a local park, and that really devastated her. So she tried to withdraw from the drugs herself, but she just couldn't do it. Like so many women in her predicament, she began to sell her body to buy drugs. Anthony invites her over to his house to party, and the party would include alcohol and, of course, crack. She had seen him around the neighborhood, and he was generally pretty quiet. She had no way of knowing that the same fate that befell Crystal Dozier was now going to be hers. She noticed a change in his demeanor rather quickly, so he forced her to undress, and then he began to perform oral sex on her. He then raped and sodomized her. So she was punched continuously in the face and in the head, and eventually he strangled her to death. He stuffed her body in a heavy-duty trash bag and hid it under the crawl space on the third floor of the home he was living in. Her family did not report her missing until her body was found. They believe that she was actually living in Akron, Ohio, with her boyfriend. They thought that she had turned her life around and she had made comments to her family, like her mom and her sister, that, you know, she was ready to move on with her new boyfriend and ready to turn her life around. And so she had plans the day that she went missing to meet up with her boyfriend at the Akron, either she was taking a bus or a train to Akron, and she never showed. So they were none the wiser. It's really sad. The next victim was LaShonda Long. She was 25 years old. She was the youngest victim he had overall. She was known for disappearing for days, much like Crystal Dozier. She was a little different in the fact that she disappeared for days, weeks, and sometimes months on end. And she went missing in August of 2008. And her family was really used to her nomadic lifestyle, and they figured that she was just out on another one of her jaunts or adventures, if you want to call it that. She did have a troubled childhood. She was born to a drug-addicted mother who could barely care for her and her five siblings. Her father was Jim Allen. He was actually a correctional officer who did his best to raise his children with a consistent parental figure. She was eventually transferred to the care of an aunt after refusing to live with her father any longer. So around her early teens, around 14 or so, she started to rebel against authority. She would run away from home looking for her mom, who was likely living in one of the many crack houses in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood of Cleveland. She would have three children by the time she was 17. Her children were eventually taken from her care and given to relatives to raise. She turned to drugs to hide the pain that she felt. Jim Allen, her father, always expected a phone call from Lashandra on his birthday, no matter what she was doing or no matter what she was going through or the last conversation they had, even if they fought. She always called. But in 2008, he would never get his call. So we don't know a lot about her murder, and this is going to be true for a lot of the women we are going to talk about. But Anthony generally kept the same MO. He forced oral sex, raped, and sodomized the majority of his victims. The only unique caveat about Lashandra's death was that Anthony decapitated her and discarded her head in a bucket. He disposed of her body in a different location, and to this day, it hasn't been found.
Wow, so he's escalating.
Yes, so I think it's very interesting from when we ended your piece with Lori Frazier. It kind of ties in because he actually attacks another victim because of a conversation about Lori Frazier. And I think that all of the women, maybe he's seeing Lori Frazier in them. Michelle Mason, she was 45 years old when she was last seen in October of 2008. Much like the other women, she had a serious drug problem. She was 16 when she decided to pack her things and move to New York. She stayed there for about 5 years until returning back home to Cleveland. It was in New York that she acquired her drug addiction, but she also contracted HIV and had been diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. She had two children by the time she had returned back to her mother's house. Since she was addicted to crack, she turned the care of her children over to her mother and her sister. She was arrested periodically for drug use and solicitation. Her mother contends that Michelle had indeed quit drugs by the time she went missing, but still enjoyed the party life. The love of partying would cost her her eye one night. During a dispute, she was shot in the face, which caused her to lose her left eye. It would be replaced with a prosthetic, but the dispute occurred as a result of Michelle not disclosing her HIV status and having unprotected sex. The man who she had sex with was angry and shot her in the face, quite literally. So Michelle survived quite a bit and the time that she returned to Cleveland. But in October, she was reported missing just after 2 days of no contact by her mother, Adeline Atterbury. Her mother began posting missing poster flyers all around the neighborhood, especially down Imperial Avenue. When she would pass through the area, the flyers were gone. She was told by the store owner of Imperial Beverage that Anthony Sowell had removed the flyers from the store. No sign of Michelle would be reported until Anthony Sowell was caught. She was murdered in the same manner as the other victims, and he buried her in his backyard next to Crystal Dozier.
So the same thing happened with Crystal Dozier. People put up flyers and then they would go missing.
So I think that's very telling because obviously, you know, Crystal and Michelle aren't the only ones who are going to be reported missing. And this is going to be something that happens quite often with the women's families when they post their missing persons flyers, especially down Imperial Avenue. He's the one who's doing it, and the Imperial Beverage owner does it, which I think is also interesting that you just, you know, he's so forthcoming with that information to her mom, and nothing's done about it. Or no, he's not questioned, like, why are you ripping this down? Which I think is really interesting. Okay, so Anthony seemed to have a dormant period in between murders in 2008. Generally, what I noticed is that he waited about 2 months before he would kill again. The next victim after Michelle Mason was Tanya Carmichael. She was 52 years old when she was last seen alive on November 10th, 2008. She was addicted to crack and wanted to have some fun, as reported by an acquaintance. She requested $20 from her mom to go get her truck door fixed. But her mom was a little concerned about giving her money because she thought she was going to be using it for drugs. But she ended up giving it to her anyway. Her truck was found several days later near Imperial Avenue with no signs of Tanya. Her door had actually been fixed. So on December 2nd, 2008, her mother Barbara contacted Cleveland police to report her daughter missing. She had been missing for over 3 weeks and no one had seen her. Her mom did disclose to police that Tanya was a drug addict and that prompted them to respond, "Well, she'll come home when the drugs run out." Except she wouldn't come home. Anthony had raped and strangled her just like he had the previous victims. He bound her hands behind her back so that she couldn't fight back. He then wrapped an electrical cord around her neck and didn't let go until Tanya's body went limp. He wrapped her in a plastic sheet and buried her in his backyard. So the police response obviously makes me angry.
Well, as they say, they're the less dead.
Yes. It's ridiculous. When I read that was the response, I was just like, really? That's what you're going to tell somebody? Like, okay, fine, she's on drugs. Maybe she's, like, passed out on the street. But even then, she still deserves some help or somebody to find her.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll get... Exactly. I'll move on from that. 6 days after Barbara reported her daughter, Tanya, missing, Gladys Wade flagged down two Cleveland police officers. She was bloodied, bruised, and terrified. So she told police what transpired that evening. She said she was walking towards her bus stop after visiting with a friend. She stopped by Imperial Beverage to grab a drink around 5:30. She left the store after buying that drink and passed by a lanky and gaunt man. He said, "Merry Christmas. How about coming back to my place and having a beer?" She politely said, "No thanks. I already have a beer, but Merry Christmas to you also." She continued walking towards the bus stop, not expecting what was about to come next. Anthony didn't like being rejected by her, and especially when he was on the prowl, so he grabbed Gladys by her shoulder and spun her around. And as he's doing this, he punches her on the side of the face, which causes her to pass out. Yeah, so, and the other thing, you know, this is at 5:30 at night. There has to be people seeing this, and it's amazing to me that whoever may have seen this didn't intervene, or, you know, and maybe nobody was out on the street. I don't know. So the next thing she knows is that she's being dragged up a driveway, and she tried to fight. You know, he's grabbing her by the turtleneck that she was wearing, and it's pulled up so far around her neck that if she had kept fighting, she would have actually strangled herself. So she stopped, but she passed out again. She comes to next to a Christmas tree. She's confused and hurting all over, so she decides to do what I think any normal person in this situation would do, and that's scream. But this causes Anthony to burst inside the door and punch her several times in the face, making it very clear what his intentions were. She struggled and fought back really hard. You know, she was a scrapper. She was going to fight for her life if she had to, and that's apparently what she had to do. She eventually was able to get to the very top of the stairs, so they exit where they were, and Anthony tackles her, causing them both to tumble down the stairs. She was trapped by the front door, and he held his hands to her throat and squeezed so tight that she knew that this was do or die. She reached for his testicles and squeezed as hard as she could, which, I mean, I would do the same thing. This forced Anthony to double over in pain, and she bolted from the house. She saw a group of men standing by the house, and when she ran to tell them that she had just been attacked, Anthony walks up very coolly and calmly and tells them to ignore her, that she had just tried to steal his watch. You know, she was a crack-addicted bitch, basically, is what he said. And the men, deciding not to get involved with this issue, walk the other way and ignore Gladys completely. Wanting to get away from Anthony as quickly as possible, she runs to a nearby pizzeria. And the owners or the staff in the pizzeria told her she needed to leave because they didn't want to be involved. And this woman's visibly injured. And the response is, you need to go. We don't want to be involved in any of this. We're not going to call the cops for you. You know, she requested that, hey, can you call 911? I need an ambulance or something. You know, I just got attacked. And their first response is, you need to go. We don't want to be involved. So they don't even call the cops for her. Now, she feels a presence behind her, and Anthony is standing there again. But this time, all he does is throw her coat towards her. Gladys was now ready to leave the neighborhood altogether and ran over 12 blocks until she finally ran into a police cruiser.
Hey, this nut is strangling me. It's strangling me. It's saying, please stop screaming. You're gonna die. And I'm just, gasping for air and grabbing at his face, clawing at his eyes. I was trying to get out. I started screaming.
What were you screaming?
Help. And then he came in and he started punching me in the face. And told my son, bitch, take your clothes off. He's strangling me. And I'm almost gone.
What do you mean he's strangling you?
Choking me to death.
What is he using?
His hands.
All right, and where are his hands?
Around my neck.
So she told officers that her blood would likely be all over the porch of the house and even inside on the stairs. She talks about punching through a pane of glass and that they would find, you know, shards of glass on the floor. Officers arrived to Anthony's house and found him scratched up. It looked like he was in a visible brawl with somebody. He was arrested for attempted rape and for murder, attempted murder. He would be released just 2 days later without any charges being filed against him formally. They claimed that there was insufficient evidence to charge him, despite the blood, clothes, and broken panes of glass found in the home. In the case notes, there was an entry that listed Gladys as not credible. She later said that the detective who was working her case, which was actually a female detective, didn't believe her and believed Anthony's claims that she was trying to rob him. So though Gladys was a crack user, she was depressed over the incident and turned to heavier drugs. Perhaps if she had been taken more seriously, the next set of murders may not have even occurred. Tanja Das was hanging out with Anthony on the night of April 21st, 2009. She had known him since 2005 and had an on-and-off-again relationship with him. One night, she was planning on bringing her friend Nancy Cobbs over to Anthony's house for a party. Anthony, and you mentioned this earlier, Haley, that he had parties at his house. Well, that's what he was regularly known for. He would have cookouts and, you know, just cook for people in the neighborhood, invite people over for a barbecue. And this was not a rare thing to happen. So her planning to go over to his house wasn't such an odd occurrence. She had always known him to be kind, and she exclaimed that he even let the women walking the street at night to come into his home and shower without sex being exchanged. She thought nothing of it when she spent the day with him, drinking, smoking crack, eating, and watching a Cleveland Cavaliers basketball game. So suddenly he gets up, shows her a purple jumpsuit that he is planning on giving to his ex-girlfriend, Lori Frazier, for her birthday. Now keep in mind, while they broke up in 2007, on the cusp of 2008, periodically whenever Lori would come back into the Mount Pleasant neighborhood, they were still engaging in a sexual relationship at times and also smoking crack, but they were never formally back together. Now, Tanja thought this was weird, and she was a little taken aback because she thought that they were on the outs. Anytime that Tanja came by, whenever Lori was present, Anthony would tell her, hey, you need to go, I'm with somebody else. She thought that this was weird because, you know, she was under the impression that they were done. Even though she's taken aback, she says, you know what, that's a really pretty jumpsuit. Lori's going to love it. And then she notices this shift in him after that conversation is over, and he brings up wanting to get more booze. All she remembers after that is being tackled to the ground with Anthony's hands around her neck. He tells her, knock 3 times on the floor if you want to live. And so she knocks. She asks why he's doing this to her, and he continuously just slaps her in the face and demands that she takes her clothes off. She didn't know why this was happening to her, so she just decided to placate his demands. He lets her go to the bathroom, and she starts thinking, okay, well, maybe I can start getting dressed and make my exit. But he orders her back into the bedroom where he's lying naked on the bed. The weird thing is, he doesn't rape her. He just forces her to lie next to him, and he doesn't touch her again. The next day, he casually just gets up and says, hey, do you want a beer? And she's still really confused, scared about what happened the night before, but she decides to play along, and so she says, yeah, I'll take a beer, even though she didn't want one. And she fakes a call to her daughter and says, hey, you know, I gotta go help my daughter out. And Anthony actually allows her to leave, but he checks on her later the next day to see if she's okay. He just says, hey, you know, how's everything going? I hope everything's okay. And she was completely terrified at this point. And when I was reading the book that we used for this case, the psychiatrist in it said that he was in a heating up and cooling down period, which is typical of sexual sadists. But what's so strange and really sad about this is that Tanja then goes to her friend Nancy Cobbs and she says, quote, he choked the fuck out of me. Tanja didn't know that Nancy already knew who Anthony was. The whole point of her inviting Nancy to Anthony's house was to introduce them to each other. So when she told her, you know, that he choked the fuck out of me, Nancy had already been acquainted with Anthony. So she looks back on it now, present day Tanja looks back on it now and wishes that she would have actually reported the assault because it may have saved her best friend's life. Nancy Cobbs was 43 years old and a mother to 3 children. She was a hard worker, according to her family, and was a very loyal friend. She, unfortunately, had a serious crack addiction, and she was last seen on April 24th, 2009, by her daughter, Audrey Williams. She left her daughter and said she was going to be going to a neighborhood store, which was likely the Imperial Beverage Store. She was never seen again after that point. And it was likely that Anthony did the same thing he did with Gladys, except since he knew Nancy, he didn't have to say, or he didn't have to attack her. All he had to do was just invite her back to his home to drink and probably smoke crack. The interesting thing about Nancy is that despite her addiction, she was still always keeping in contact with her family. And she was reported missing just after 24 hours of no contact with her daughter, Audrey. By the time that she had been reported missing, Anthony had already strangled her with a rope and a cloth mixture. He wrapped her body in black trash bags and a comforter and threw her in the crawl space of his home on the 3rd floor. Then all of a sudden, it was like he was on a nonstop killing spree in June of 2009. His next 3 victims, Talicia Forston, age 31, Janice Webb, aged 49, and Kim Yvette Smith, aka Candy, age 44, were all murdered in quick succession in the exact same manner as the previous victims. Now, listeners may be wondering, when are these murders going to stop? And that would actually be in October of 2009. On October 11, 2009, Detective Richard Durst began working on LaTundra Billups' rape case. Now, I know I haven't mentioned her yet, but her case is actually really, really important, so I wanted to save it for right now. Detective Durst had the case in September, but he was unable to really reach LaTundra because she was so hard to get a hold of. She failed to show up to their scheduled appointment to provide her statement, but finally agreed to show on October 27th, 2009. And what she told Detective Durst was that in September, Anthony had invited her over to his home, to drink, smoke crack, party, whatever. She had no qualms about it. She had done it before in the past. She makes her way over to his house. She's wearing a pink sweater at the time, and this comes into play later on. It's very important to the case. So they get to drinking, they're partying, but then all of a sudden, he turns on her and punches her right in the face. You know, and LaTundra, even though she's very tiny, if you see pictures of her, she's a very tiny woman. She's a scrapper, so she fought back really, really hard. She was kicking him, biting him, punching him back, but he eventually overpowered her and wrapped an electrical cord around her throat and basically choked her out until she was unconscious. Now, when somebody is strangled in that way, even though they aren't dead, they do lose control of their faculties, so she urinated on herself and she also defecated on herself. But a couple hours later, she comes to, and the way the book describes it is kind of in a classic movie way, you know, when the camera pans down on somebody who's just like knocked out cold, and then all of a sudden they have this sharp jerk movement and breathe in really heavily. That's exactly what happened to LaTundra. She wakes up and Anthony is a little bit startled by her. He must have been like, oh, damn, you're not dead. She finally decides to play cool. And she's like, I thought you were my friend. Like, why are you doing this to me or something like that? And, you know, he was just like, shut up. And I believe he rapes her as well. But she notices that after he's kind of gone through his little rape scenario with her, he lets her get ready, you know, and she can't take her underwear because she's obviously soiled them. And her pink sweater is actually torn. And so she tries to make a light joke of it so that she can make him feel at ease. And she's like, man, I thought you were my friend. You're tearing my clothes up. And he goes, well, you know, I can't let you go home with a torn sweater. So he takes her down to the basement. And at this point, I would be terrified. I'd be like, you know what? It's cool. I can walk outside without a shirt. Don't worry about it. But he leads her down to the basement and he has these bags of clothes down there. And he tells her, you know, like, pick a shirt. And at the time when I was reading the book, I was like, oh my God, these are all like the women that he's so far murdered. But I don't think now looking back at it that they were, because it was a huge trash bag of clothes. So it may have been like his sister's or something like that, just clothes he collected. So he gives her a shirt. She leaves her pink sweater deliberately there. And, you know, she files a police report. She goes through the process, has a rape kit done, has pictures taken of her injuries. But it's not until later in October, of course, whenever she finally meets with Detective Durst and she goes over the entire incident with him. You know, she was depressed after this incident, of course, and she had amped up her drug usage. So she was really, really aching for some drugs when she was having this conversation because it was so traumatic for her. She said that if you go back to his house, you are going to find my clothes. My underwear are on the second or third floor. She described what they look like, and she said my pink sweater is there. It has a hole or a tear on it, and it's going to be either in the basement or he may have taken it up to the second or third floor where my underwear are. So on October 29th, 2009, a search warrant was issued to search the residence of one Anthony E. Sowell. So when SWAT arrived, he wasn't home, but that wasn't their intention anyway. They had a no-knock warrant. So that means that they just grab their battering ram, don't even knock, and just, you know, shove it through the door and bust in. He wasn't there, so anticlimactic, no fighting the police or resisting arrest. Detectives and SWAT entered the house and began to search for evidence that LaTundra said would be there. They made their way to the second and third floors of the home and found not only the pink sweater, but also her soiled underwear. And they had noticed that the scene that she had described, so there were CDs scattered everywhere, the place was just a mess, especially on the second and third floor. The SWAT team officers and detectives who were on the scene doing the search or conducting the search started complaining about the foul odor. Some recognized the unmistakable scent of decaying human remains. They stumbled upon two bodies covered loosely with a black plastic bag, and slowly, as they made their way through the entire house. They found the remaining, really 10 bodies and one head because, like I said, one was decapitated and the body was never recovered. So 2 days later, he's caught walking down the street and he's arrested without incident. He didn't resist or anything. And while he's being interrogated by detectives, he completely denies knowing about the dead bodies in his home, even though they're in a crawl space and basically in a guest room or a foyer. And he later angrily says, after he's continuously questioned and he keeps denying it, he says, "I've told you the same thing over and over and you ain't been listening to me. I don't remember actually killing nobody." And the detectives don't waver. They keep questioning him. He finally says, "Well, yeah, I guess I did that. It had to be me because who else would have done it, essentially?" So I thought that was really interesting because he always says, "Oh, I don't remember, you know, I don't remember killing anybody." But then he'll go back and say, "Well, yeah, that could have been me because who else would have done it?" So he's essentially confessing, but then not confessing. And they try and, you know, pull the honor code of the military and say, you know, like, you have an obligation to be honest. If you're a Marine, you're going to be honest and you need to help these families out. And one of the things he says is like, "I can't help them." And the interview basically concludes. He's charged with 11 counts of aggravated murder, 70 counts of rape, kidnapping, tampering with evidence, and abuse of a corpse. His plea was entered initially as not guilty by reason of insanity, but then he changed it to just not guilty. And I think that's because his lawyer probably convinced him that when you're on crack, you can't say you're crazy for doing what you did. Now, there is some correlation from what I was reading that alcohol use and crack use do cause these like jumps in anger and violent tendencies. But it seems like he already had that way before, even when he was in the Marine Corps and he was in Japan, you know, basically assaulting these Japanese sex workers. This isn't really an excuse because this is a continued pattern of behavior. And at the time he wasn't doing drugs. The women that he raped would testify of their attacks, but prison buddies of his would, and some of his siblings and other family members would testify on his behalf, saying that he was a model prisoner and he was a nice and quiet guy. He was eventually found guilty and sentenced to death. He's currently in the Chillicothe Correctional Institution.
He has since appealed his conviction, stating that his Sixth Amendment right was violated because his pretrial hearing was closed and not public. The Ohio Supreme Court eventually rejected this claim and said that it would have had no impact on the trial. In December of 2011, the house on Imperial Avenue was demolished. City leaders promised to make it a memorial of some sort, but never followed through, to the ire of the victim's family and residents in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood.
So, what are your thoughts overall?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, when he got out of prison the first time, it almost seems like he tried really hard to get back into prison. Like, he did all of those petty crimes and never was sent back.
Just kind of hoping, like, hey, this is what I need, because he couldn't go back to the military, basically.
Right, and I don't. It probably wasn't even consciously. I mean, it just seems like he was basically, I would say, a model citizen before the rape, and I mean, at least what we know. And then he goes to prison, and then he gets out, and he starts with this long rap sheet of crimes. Maybe, you know, subconsciously he was trying to go back to prison where he felt, you know, accepted and he felt like he was actually, you know, maybe doing something with his life. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I see that. But see, I can't explain the assaults and the sadism with the Japanese, because I want to, or with the Japanese sex workers, because I want to say that this all, you know, kind of happened as a result of his relationship with Lori crumbling, but he had already demonstrated this sadism, you know, really early on in his early 20s.
So I'm imagining that, this is just my personal opinion, that because I didn't read about, like, his first sex experience or anything, but I'm thinking probably what happened was he was going through puberty when his seven nieces and nephews had to move in with his mom, and because she would beat them naked, he probably at one point got aroused because he's going through puberty as he watched his mom beat his nieces, and maybe that just triggered this, oh, I got aroused watching somebody get beat. You know, that just, it's a very vicious cycle.
So that actually happened. That's true, because look at Albert Fish, my homie, right? Everybody thinks that I'm like, you know, just so thrilled talking about him.
We know.
I know, sorry.
So we don't think we
one
know.
Of the, you know my deepest, darkest secrets. So Albert Fish actually had the same experience. He was in a boarding school of sorts, or, you know, state school is what we would equate it to, somebody who's in foster care or an orphanage. And he was basically subjected to the same thing, except he was the one being beaten, but he equated pleasure with pain, which I think is pretty close to what you were saying in terms of what Anthony experienced, you know, recognizing that he didn't understand what his body was going through and didn't understand those feelings and felt aroused because of that, you know, which it's interesting, but also really sad. But I don't know that, you know, I don't know how much of an impact. I mean, I guess it had a huge impact on him seeing that. And he actually goes into testimony. I mean, he describes his childhood. And I think at some point in his testimony, he doesn't go into detail because he doesn't want to talk about it. But he, I think, was molested by an aunt or another relative of his, a female relative.
Well, that would definitely add to it as well. It would be interesting to know his first sexual experience, to sort of get an idea of, you know, because that's sort of what my fascination is why, you know, why did he become a sadist? But I do think you're right. I think that he was a sadist, you know, since at least being in the Marines, but Lori's breakup with him just caused him to crumble. You know, they say that it's usually like one thing that kind of pushes them over the edge, you know, like a death or something traumatizing to them. And probably losing Lori was too much. You know, if you kill them, they can't leave you. It's interesting that he buried all of them in his house. You know, that, I mean, that's another thing. They're literally not leaving him. They're still right there with him. I would love to know why he buried LaShonda's body somewhere else, but only kept her head.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the weird thing too, okay, so what we didn't really go into was the identification. We know who the victims are in a timeline, but that's not how they were discovered or how they were identified. Some weren't identified for at least a year or two. And like I said, one of the victims wasn't even reported missing until after there was a discovery of bodies on his property. And it wasn't until then that their family members were like, you know, she might be a victim, so I'm going to go ahead and go report her missing. I mean, maybe there was concern, I don't know, but I would think that if one of my family members, regardless of if they were involved in drugs or whatever, that if I hadn't heard from them for at least, say, a year or two, that I would at least do some type of missing persons report, and they may find them, like, you know, with a needle in their arm on the sidewalk, but at least I know where you're at. At least, you know, this one time. So I thought that was really interesting. Also, the police response, you know, that was my biggest thing. When I was researching this, at least my pieces and stuff, I was really, really mad. You know, I had to take breaks because it was really affecting me in terms of, I was just getting so upset for these women because, you know, I didn't even want to talk about them, you know, being on drugs or doing drugs. But that's really the primary reason why he selected them or why he was able to entice them, so we have to mention it. But just because somebody is in, is a sex worker or addicted to drugs doesn't mean that they deserve to be raped and murdered because of it. Now, are they probably more likely to be susceptible to those violent crimes? Yes. Does that mean they deserve it? No.
I agree. It's devastating that they thought they were just going over there to this nice neighborly guy just to do something that they were addicted to. It's really sad.
A lot of the research where we pulled from, or the majority of, what I was reading was from a book that you actually found. So can you tell the listeners where they can find this book or what the book title is called? Who's the author?
Yeah, so I found this book called House of Horrors, The Shocking True Story of Anthony Sowell, the Cleveland Strangler. And it's written by Robert Sberna. That's Sberna. It actually includes death row interviews with Anthony, so that's really cool.
So that wraps up the case that we are covering today. Our crossover episode, I think, has been a great success. Haley, thank you so much for coming on and joining me. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that the listeners enjoyed it. I know that this is a break from you, or a break for you, in terms of how you're presenting your case. But I think you did an amazing job. And I, again, just thank you so much for coming. So if you could just let people know again where they can find you, where they can find the show, and then we can peace out.
You can find Murder Road Trip on Facebook at MRT Podcast and on Instagram and Twitter at Murder Trip.
You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast. Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is truecrimefanclub.com.